Welcome to the Life Sciences Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Wise, and today it's all about the realm of dementia. We're going to be speaking with Philip Scheltens, widely regarded as one of, if not the, top global opinion leaders in the field of dementia and neurodegenerative diseases as a whole. Philip is a clinician neurologist, professor of cognitive neurology, and head of the Alzheimer Center Amsterdam, the research institute that he founded. He has authored over 1,000 publications in peer-reviewed journals and is one of the most cited scientists in the world. Philip has dedicated his entire career to improving the diagnosis and care of patients with dementia and has pioneered the implementation of novel biomarkers for clinical practice. It was truly an honor to speak with him, and I hope you enjoy our conversation and learn as much as I did. So, without further ado, here is my conversation with Philip Scheltens. So as one of the world's foremost thought leaders on the topic and research of dementia and neurodegenerative diseases as a whole, I think there's only one logical question for me to ask to appropriately kick us off. I'm sure that the majority of our listeners have heard of dementia or may even know a bit about it. But so we all have a good working definition, what is dementia and what distinctively different conditions fall under its umbrella?
Yeah. Thank you. Great question. And it's exactly the word is appropriate. It's an umbrella term. So dementia is nothing else than losing the capacity of your cognitive functions, such as memory, language, praxis, executive function. So that's planning, organizing things, multitasking. And if you lose one of those or more than once, and it actually interferes with your daily life, then we call it dementia. But the main sort of important thing to point at is that it's a term, it's an umbrella, it's a syndrome. It doesn't sort of equal a diagnosis. It's just the fact that you are, compared to a certain level you had before, you're declining and it is interfering in your daily living, work or social life. Then you say this is a dementia syndrome. And then the quest starts with finding what is the actual cause of the dementia. And then neurodegenerative diseases come into play. I mean, the most important cause, the most frequent cause is Alzheimer's disease, but it's not the only one. So you have other dementia types, which is frontotemporal dementia, dementia with Lewy bodies, vascular causes of dementia, or mixed cases of all of those. It all may happen, but that's actually where the doctor comes in after saying, well, this is probably a dementia, then you have to find the actual cause and then define that cause by sort of mentioning the disease and finding the real origin of that syndrome.
Right. And so I know for myself that I didn't realize that there were so many different types of dementias and that it's key to understand the underlying biology in order to define what type of dementia is at play. And also that, as you mentioned, it's relative to previous cognitive function, and that dementia is a continuum, not an easily differentiated and segmented disease. But great, now that we have a grasp on the general premise of dementia, let's dive into the more unknown multifactorial causes of the disease. And you alluded to it that Alzheimer's disease is the most prevalent form of dementia. So what defines Alzheimer's disease as a distinct type of dementia, and where do we stand on what we know, or maybe I should say what we don't know about the pathophysiology, or rather the mechanisms of developing Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, so the disease we call Alzheimer's disease has been defined more than 100 years ago, actually by Alois Alzheimer himself, by describing the neuropathology of the disease, which is basically the amyloid plaques and the neurofibrillary tangles. And he could only describe it in sort of macroscopic terms, but the actual what constitutes the plaques and tangles was actually discovered in 1996. So the amyloid core of the amyloid plaques and tau protein in the neurofibrillary tangles. That is basically what defines Alzheimer's disease as a neuropathological disease. Now, all the features that are sort of the clinical features of Alzheimer's disease are very, very sort of variable. And we have the classic dementia syndrome, which is an amnestic disorder where you sort of you lose the capacity to remember what you did yesterday or the day before or what you just did or what you just talked about. But it also may cause language problems with the language variant of Alzheimer's disease, or even frontal type behavioral disturbances are also possible to be caused by these neurofibrillary tangles and plaques. So there is a whole sort of wide array of clinical phenotypes, but the basis is always the plaques and the tangles. And of course, following that, also neurodegeneration, so loss of function in neurons and synapses. And that's basically what constitutes Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, so the core features are these plaques and tangles, and that is what differentiates Alzheimer's disease from other dementias.
Yeah.
So maybe if we can go a bit more into what these plaques and tangles are and what we know about them. And I guess this may be a little bit more of an opinion piece, but are these plaques and tangles what you think are the consequence of Alzheimer's disease, or are they just related to a prior event that then results in the formation of them?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And you don't expect me to answer this definitively, because that's what the question is, of course. And some people have defined this. There is a stage before plaques and tangles, which is called the cellular phase of Alzheimer's disease, where a lot of things are already ongoing in terms of neuroinflammatory processes and sort of, yeah, things that are probably not well known, perhaps even vascular issues. But at some point in time, I think that the basis still is that there is this misfolding of the amyloid protein, which is has a normal route of sort of from APP, a beta is formed, and it's actually broken down in a normal way with the alpha secretase action. And in the abnormal way, it's by enzymes like beta secretase and gamma secretase, there is this toxic form of amyloid that's being formed. And this already in the very early phase actually hits neurons, hits synapses, and also aggregates to form plaques. So yes, the plaques are not the earliest phenomenon. It's actually the oligomeric form of A-beta 42 in a very toxic oligomeric form. That is probably the first signal that something is going wrong. And then ultimately the plaques are being formed. So in that sense, you may say that plaques or development of aggregated amyloid is in a way a later stage. And then the discussion is also, when does tau appear, or phosphorylated tau? So when are these neurofibrillary tangles actually being formed? Is this already in the beginning, or is it a little bit later? So the classical way of thinking about it is that you have first, there is an insult, something goes wrong, and then then this misfolding process starts, and you have oligomeric A-beta 42, and then this starts the aggregating, and then perhaps tau is being formed. But other people say, well, it happens at the same time, or there are also people saying, well, perhaps even tau misfolding is happening earlier than amyloid misfolding. So that's the jury is still out there, but I would say the classical sort of hypothesis is still, I would say, mainstream, in the sense that there is something, and that's of course the question that nobody can answer: why is this happening? If you don't carry the sort of autosomal dominant gene, why would you actually start misfolding your protein and start developing a toxic A-beta 42? So the question is why. We cannot answer that. Something else has happened before that actually brings this whole process about. But after that, it's quite straightforward. And ultimately, plaques will arise and will be present. And tau is formed, and neurofibrillary tangles are formed. So
it's almost a classic case of which came first, the chicken or the egg.
Yeah.
But great. I know we are going to come back to these plaques a little bit later when we talk about Biogen. But first, I know there's been a lot of work related to creating a more succinct and quantitative methodology for diagnosing dementia and Alzheimer's disease, you know, moving away from that historical syndrome-based clinical diagnosis to a more biological-based approach. So what can you tell us about this current paradigm shift and the research efforts in this realm, and how are biomarkers playing a role in this process?
Yeah. Thank you. That's one of my favorite topics, actually, and it's so intriguing and it's so fascinating to hear this story in that sense. So when I started my sort of career end of the 80s, early 90s, there was no other way than just defining the patient as by its syndrome. So you had a patient who had a memory disorder and there was some executive dysfunction. And yes, indeed, there were some troubles at home or at work. So you say, well, then I would exclude a vitamin deficiency and I make a CT scan, there is no tumor, then it's probably Alzheimer's disease. So you diagnose a fatal brain disease by just excluding a few things and then assuming that this process in the brain is present. So we, as research community, we were increasingly dissatisfied with that way of diagnosing the disease. And luckily, biomarkers came around. So first of all, we had MRI, showing medial temporal atrophy, so atrophy in the hippocampal region that was shown to be quite sensitive and specific for the presence of Alzheimer's disease. And then we got the opportunity in the 90s to look at CSF and for the first time we're able to look at the levels of A-beta 42, A-beta 40, and tau and phosphorylated tau in CSF as direct consequences of the processes that were taking place in the brain. And then in 2004, for the very first time, we were able to visualize the amount of amyloid plaques by using a ligand, which was at that time PIB, Pittsburgh Imaging Compound B, after Pittsburgh Imaging Compound A had failed. This was the next one. It's actually a very interesting story how that came about, but that's a different one. And then we were able to visualize the amount of amyloid. So ultimately, taking all these developments together, a bunch of researchers among myself and Bruno Dubois in 2007, we first set out to make a new framework and say, well, if you diagnose a amnestic syndrome, you have a complaint and you have a cognitive impairment, but you also have the presence of medial temporal atrophy or amyloid PET abnormality or CSF abnormality, you can already call this Alzheimer's disease. But it was still a link between symptoms, signs, and biomarkers. But gradually, from 2007 onwards, we became more sort of relying and we became more confident that these biomarkers actually really, really sort of were indicative of the underlying process. And also in a very early phase of the disease, even before signs and symptoms had occurred. And that ultimately led to a new framework in 2018, led by Cliff Jack and many others and authorized by the NIA and Alzheimer's Association. I was a part of that working group. But very exciting. And we said very daringly, and I'm a clinician, so really for me, it was also a step. I said, well, it really doesn't matter if a patient has syndrome A or syndrome B or syndrome C or no syndrome at all, as long as you have abnormal biomarkers, notably a presence of amyloid and the presence of tau, phosphorylated tau, we call this Alzheimer's disease. And this is really a concept shift because the disease was then diagnosed outside of the framework of dementia. So we had now, after that, we have discussions with our patients and saying, well, you came to me, you have complaints. I see that your biomarkers are abnormal. You have the disease, but you're not demented. So we disentangled this syndrome dementia from the actual disease by using biomarkers. And I think from that time on, from that day on, I think we were also able to design our clinical trials more rationally in terms, if you want to influence the underlying pathology, if it be amyloid or tau, you have to have the patients who have actually have this pathology. So you have to do your biomarkers first. And then the syndrome is actually less important. And that actually led to, after a decade of failures, to a more rational and more meaningful and more clever way of designing clinical trials using the biomarkers as the defining biology and the defining sort of definition, I would say, for the disease instead of the clinical phenotype.
It's fascinating to consider that at the beginning of your practice that you were basically going through a process of elimination diagnosis.
Yeah, and I can tell you, Alexander, it was really very sort of insecure times because you were never sure that you made a diagnosis properly. And the only way to make that sort of more confident is following the patients over time. So I've learned a lot by just following these patients. And if they declined, then I said, well, it was probably indeed Alzheimer's disease because there was no other way of defining that disease, no other.
So it comes down to following the continuum as well,
Correct.
Which I'm sure when you have hundreds or rather thousands of patients, it's difficult to synthesize this continuum for all of them.
Also in that days, I mean, diagnosis of Alzheimer's is still a sort of, yeah, for many people, it's like cancer. It's a fatal diagnosis. So you have to be really sure. And we were not sure at that time. So I'm really sure that we misdiagnosed a lot of patients. And actually before the biomarkers, patients got misdiagnosed, even included in clinical trials. I mean, the famous example of the bapineuzumab studies, where 33% of the patients in the non-APOE4 carrier arm didn't have even amyloid. So at that time, a clinical diagnosis was always imperfect, always imperfect. And right. I learned a lot by using, I've been working with biomarkers since the early 90s, and I learned as a clinician also a lot of the value of these biomarkers, incorporating it in your clinical practice.
You mentioned this idea of essentially the terminal diagnosis that you get with dementia, and you compared it to cancer. So let's talk about the more macro perspective to understand what dementia means to the population as a whole.
Yeah.
So globally, people are living longer, and the overall number of individuals older than age 60 is rapidly increasing. Since dementia is a disease that disproportionately afflicts older individuals, the number of patients with dementia is rising as well. So as of the recording of this podcast, there are around 50 million people living with dementia worldwide. By 2050, that number is expected to triple to over 150 million. So what does this massive jump in patient volume mean for the world as a whole?
Yeah, it's good that you raised this point. I think what is very important to realize that this number of patients now already is actually equal to the patients who have a cancer, are suffering from a disorder in the oncology spectrum. So it is as important. That's number one. The second thing is that dementia by itself sort of distinguish it from every other chronic disease by the fact that people become dependent on others. So the issue with not only the numbers of these 150 million in the end, there are three times as many patients as these 150 million taking care of such a patient. And that ultimately will lead to loss of economical power of people, because you can either take care of your husband or your father or your mother, or take care or participate in the process of the economy doing your job and making money. And also the healthcare system will not be able to absorb all these patients and take care of all these patients, because still in the end, until we find a cure, until we find a way to stop the disease, ultimately people will always end in a nursing home facility or a very sort of institutional care, because you are not able to care for yourself, and ultimately your spouse or your family cannot take care of you. So that is what distinguishes dementia as a horrible sort of scenario for the future from other chronic diseases, where patients still can take care of themselves to a certain level. And that is why we have to really find a way to stop the disease before dementia occurs.
You're painting this picture where it's almost as if dementia is this quiet pandemic, slowly creeping up on us as the disease takes more individuals into its grasp and siphons off more of the global GDP into taking care of these patients. You know, one would assume that given the massive impact of dementia, that there must be an inordinate amount of research in the field, especially going into finding the underlying causes and etiology of the disease and hopefully a cure, which is obviously the goal with any disease. But if you look at dementia research from a therapeutics perspective, it's clear that the field is moving much slower than others.
Yeah.
And you mentioned oncology, and that's a great example. And it's obviously hard to understand what's going on in the brain without the tools to see what's happening in vivo. And now you've mentioned the biomarkers, but there are also various diagnostic tools such as fMRI and PET scans. So can you speak a little bit more as to what these newer imaging technologies are doing for the impact in the field and what this looks like from a clinical perspective?
Yeah. So just to nuance a little bit, I mean, I think you're right in the sense that compared to, for instance, oncology or HIV or even cardiovascular disease, where the numbers are actually as high as with dementia, or probably even lower, there is little less research going on in the dementia space. But be careful, it is also a quite a young sort of field. I think the whole field has actually basically started by mid-90s, where the research really became meaningful in this sense, because Ronald Reagan declared that he had Alzheimer's disease, and then NIH funding started to be sort of rolled out. And before that, it was not really an issue. When I started end of the 80s, early 90s, nobody worked on dementia. Nobody was interested in Alzheimer's disease. The very first conferences on Alzheimer's disease in 1989, there were 200 people over there, and it was just not an issue. So we have to realize that the field is quite young. And in that relatively short time period, I think we have made an enormous amount of progress from a clinical sort of non-specific diagnosis to a very specific biomarker-based diagnosis. And I think that ultimately will sort of progress into what I see as the future, is that we are able to dissect the brain into the diverse neurodegenerative components by looking with the biomarkers at not only A-beta, tau, but also TDP-43, alpha-synuclein, all the other elements, and of course, inflammation. So we should be able to precisely diagnose all the underlying processes in order to find cures for each of these individual processes, ultimately, just like we did in oncology. But in oncology, we started more than 20 years before. So they have a real sort of advantage in that sense, and much more money has gone into it. And it's always the result of success in a certain area is the combination of money and people that are investing their time in it. And I think we have to go there with dementia. That's why awareness is so extremely important, that where we fund research and more people should work in research, and then we'll find ultimately cures for all these different neurodegenerative parts.
Of course, right. It sounds like the imaging and biomarkers are really a key portion to understanding the root cause and underlying mechanisms of the disease. Yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned this 20-year gap between the progress in dementia research and oncology research, and maybe it's just the rule of twos or 20s here. But it's interesting because the past two decades have been a little stagnant for the dementia realm, at least from a therapeutics perspective. Until very recently, when Biogen broke this therapeutic dry spell. Now, their Alzheimer's drug, aducanumab, was granted FDA approval very recently, this past June, which is even more exciting because this is the very first treatment targeted at the underlying pathology of Alzheimer's disease. So that said, there has been some recent controversy behind the efficacy of the drug. So what can you tell us about aducanumab's method of action, and what are your thoughts on the overall efficacy of the drug from both a clinical perspective and, that I think this is key, a research momentum perspective?
So first of all, I think the aducanumab story is a very interesting story, because it started in Zurich in Europe with a clever observation of two scientists, Roger Nitsch and Christopher Hock, who discovered that people over 90 in the university actually were very clever and still not demented. While the idea has always been that if you get that old, I mean, you probably will develop a form of dementia. So when they started, and they made this very clever decision to take blood from all these individuals that were actually resilient or resistant to the Alzheimer's disease process, and they, with a process they call reverse translational medicine, they actually they found antibodies against A-beta, but also antibodies against TDP-43, antibodies against tau, and they actually sort of got that from the blood, and they sort of transversed that in a long process to finally aducanumab, but also other antibodies that they have produced now. And the first one, it's a completely human antibody. So aducanumab is completely human, and it's humanized for use by Biogen. And I think it's a potent antibody. It's probably not the most potent antibody, but it actually really clears through a process, because it doesn't really enter the blood-brain barrier, but it's through the sink process from outside of the blood-brain barrier, it does dissolve the amyloid plaques, and probably also has an effect on the oligomeric or the formation of oligomeric A-beta. So by that, all their studies have shown in phase one and the two phase three studies, unfortunately, they have skipped phase two. We can discuss that. I think that's a major mistake, but here we are. But all their studies showed that there was a massive an impressive reduction of the amount of amyloid in plaques using amyloid PET. 70 to 80% reduction if you measure with centiloids. And that has also been proven by other following antibodies like donanemab and also lecanemab. So that is a class effect. That's actually an effect of using potent monoclonal antibodies against A-beta. You will reduce the amount of plaques and actually remove. Some of the scans actually became completely negative, and that is really something. Now, the question here is whether this translates into a clinical effect. And there, of course, we are hindered by the fact that all these the two phase three studies were hampered by the fact that they were incomplete because they were stopped midway, and then they had to analyze what was going on, et cetera, et cetera. You know the story. And ultimately, they came up with one positive trial and one negative trial. So the positive trial showed an effect on CDR sum of boxes after 18 months of treatment. And the negative trial didn't show that. So from my perspective, I don't mind that much. I think we have now, for the very first time, a drug that actually works on the mechanism, works on the disease process itself. And by God, it actually removes amyloid plaque to a great extent. It is like reducing your tumor in the breast or wherever to a minimum size. It's actually a real sort of effect. And then what we have to realize is that you have been building up your plaques for 10, 15 years, then looking into a trial at a certain point, you start this with mild AD or prodromal AD, and then you have 18 months to look at the clinical effect, and the clinical effect is measured by a very crude interview, which we call the CDR. So it's actually a very fine-grained quantitative measure to look at the disease effect on PET, and a very crude qualitative measure of measuring clinical effect. So for me, I don't mind that much that we didn't see it in 18 months. I'm very convinced, and I think the FDA took the right decision to say, if you remove all this amyloid, you may expect that in due course, there will be a clinical effect, but you just have to wait a little bit longer. And of course, you have to treat as long as possible with the highest possible dose. So I think the follow-up and the next studies will show that this is a good approach. And this is not the only approach. It will not be the single drug that we will treat all our patients with for the next 10 years. No, it's just a beginning. And you talk about momentum. I sense this as a real enormous momentum for the field. Finally, somebody got approval with a sort of disease-modifying drug. And now many other drugs will follow that work on the different aspects of Alzheimer's disease, amyloid, tau, inflammation, neuronal loss, synaptic loss, you name it. And we have to work on all of those. But now we are confident that the bar has been set. It is possible to get approval. And that's the field really needed that. The field really needed that.
So it's almost like this is the final piece of the puzzle. And now the floodgates have opened and each portion of this disease is going to be piecewise dissected and attacked at its core.
Exactly.
Perfect. Well, I'm glad I hit the nail on the head with that one. Yeah. So let's chat a little bit more about aducanumab as a whole, but more importantly, the clinical trials. Keeping in mind the recent controversy and that the drug was fast-tracked through the accelerated approval pathway and they didn't have a phase two trial, what do you think about the overall FDA approval threshold for dementia drugs? I mean, they said that the need for treatment is urgent, and you've given your opinion on the drug as a whole, but can you dive a bit deeper into that threshold of what the FDA is looking for?
Yeah, well, it's so I thought that the decision of the FDA was very carefully worded, if you read it. And the accelerated approval doesn't really mean that it was accelerated in the sense that it was fast-tracked, but it means that they have looked at it in a different way, saying this is a disease that is fatal. There is no cure available. It is a huge economic, social sort of impact. And that's why we have approved a drug that has shown an effect on the disease itself, with which we may expect that there will be a clinical effect later on. But we acknowledge that at the moment, the clinical efficacy is disputed. And that's because the trials were imperfect. So, and I think that is, well, Biogen to blame, or who else to blame, that they skipped phase two and that they didn't do the due process from phase one to phase two. And then the phase three should have been designed with only the highest dose for a long period of time, et cetera, et cetera. But it's all in hindsight. But then we would have had this evidence as well. But I'm so, so I understand the controversy, but I do also understand, think that we owe it to our patients that we take responsibility as clinicians and say, well, we have this drug now, we're going to use it as best as we can, and we're going to follow these patients, and we are going to not sell it as a wonder drug, but as a first sort of means of treating this disease and giving some hope to the patients who are really very early in the process. Because we also have to realize, we have to be honest, those patients who have been longer in the process have a more severe dementia, motor dementia, they will not benefit at all.
Right, and it's certainly key to keep everything in perspective for a drug like this. And you're certainly on the dot that for these later stage patients, the drug is not designed for them and it's not right for them. And it's important for the patients to understand, maybe depending on how late stage, it's important for their families to understand that this is not the right treatment for them. So we've done some historical and present-looking analyses. Now let's do a little future thought here. So, in your opinion, what are the most exciting therapies or other areas of research that are being studied now and to be on the lookout for in the near future?
Yeah. So first of all, I think the future will be characterized by developing more biomarkers for the underlying processes. So we have amyloid, we have tau, but we need a lot more information. We also need to probably take care a little bit more of the vascular component. There's a lot of people who actually worry that the vascular component is not taken care of, and it is a very important component in the elderly, where there's usually mixed disease. So perhaps we should also focus a little bit more on, yeah, how we can influence this vascular component already in an earlier part of the disease. And then I would say what seems to be very logical for me is that we should take care of the genetic parts. So we have, of course, the autosomal dominant genes. They are the sort of causative of the disease, but there is a very small population. But here, perhaps a gene therapy we should look at. And I think the elephant in the room has always been APOE4. It is the most consistent risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. 60% of the patient with clinically diagnosed AD carries one or two A4 alleles. So why not attack E4 and its risk increasing probabilities by, for instance, reducing the effect from A4 to A3? Or introducing the Christchurch E3 mutation because we have seen that it is protective. We have now also the PCLC2 protective variant that we could probably sort of turn into a protective drug. So I think from the genetic and TREM2, not to forget, which is also a genetic factor and has important roles to play in the inflammatory process. So I think if we take a better look at what's happening on the genetic sort of a field of discovery, we could take some lessons there and tailor our drug development towards that. And I also think what I think also is very important is targeting tau as the other important proponent, either by antibodies or vaccine. I saw the very interesting Axon study that I was part of with this very sort of interesting vaccine that targets the mid-domain of the tau protein, and it seems to be very effective. But also the Ionis approach with antisense oligonucleotide against the tau. So there are a lot of possibilities now to attack more than one pathology, I would say, in Alzheimer's disease. And probably we need to do this ultimately all at the same time. There will be a cocktail. When we look 10 years from now or 15 years from now, we will have a cocktail to start treating our patients with. And I think that's would be my outlook for the future.
You paint a very interesting and optimistic picture with that one. And I hope that is the case where there's a cocktail that can hit all areas of this multi-headed dragon of the disease. And it's important to get every different variation of the disease. Otherwise, you're leaving one patient population out. So let's shift a bit here. Well, I guess it's still forward-looking thinking, but you recently began the move from clinician scientists, treating patients and spearheading research efforts to leading a highly specialized dementia investment fund. So first, Can you tell us a little bit about the ideas behind this fund, who is on your team, and what the ultimate goals of the LSP Dementia Fund are?
Yeah, thank you for asking. So first of all, I have to answer the question, why did I make this transfer? And I didn't make it completely, yeah? So I'm still seeing patients. I'm still having wearing my academic hat, but I do this part-time, and I start leading the Dementia Fund last year in October. I made a partial move, but I will move completely in a couple of years' time. And it is because I'm profoundly sort of convinced that the progress that we have made in the last 20, 30 years on the biomarkers has to be translated in progress into drug development. And the reason we haven't got so far, and the reason we still cannot treat our patients, is because there was not enough innovation. We have looked at the large, at Biogen and the Roche and the Pfizer of this world and say, give us a drug and do something. But we have, they are not really, and this is not to blame anybody, they are not really innovative in their thinking. And Big Pharma has actually sort of almost sold out all their basic research, and they are actually looking around the world what's happening. So I thought what is missing in this space is a funding for real discoveries that take place in universities or small biotech, and to help them go from these early discoveries through phase one, proper phase two, and then phase three. Because I think the real innovation takes place in biotech. We have seen this with the COVID vaccines. And what is needed in the field of dementia and neurodegeneration is actually the mechanism of funding that research, because that is really not present. If you compare it to oncology and cardiovascular disease, HIV, there's relatively little funding, and there's actually not one single specialized fund that actually has the expertise and the knowledge to look for these companies and to invest wisely in them. So it's not only that we're collecting money to invest in these early stage companies and help them with our expertise and my whole network that I built up over the last 30 years. All the colleagues want to help them go from phase one to phase two and do the proper thing, but also get some money into it and sort of help them in two ways, not only scientific advice, but also funding. And of course, we cannot do this on our own. We are only one fund, but we aim to increase the fund size tremendously this year, and to be able to invest in as many companies as we can, and then start a second fund. And hopefully other people will start setting up these funds as well, because I think neurodegeneration is the next thing now after oncology. We are now where oncology was 15 years ago, and there is only one answer to the demand of drugs, is to develop them wisely with the proper amount of funding. And we aim to do this with the LSP Dementia Fund. And I'm very, very privileged, because LSP has 30 years of history of already investing in the life sciences. They've been extremely successful, and they build a career in oncology, immunology, and cardiovascular disease, and not in neuroscience, because at that time when they started, there was hardly any neuroscience research that they could fund. And that's why we came together to the conclusions a couple of years ago that we have to start this new dementia fund. And we actually started last year in December with our first closing. We have done already two investments. We're looking at number three and number four. And at the same time, we're looking for partners to help us increase the fund size and to help us make more investments and larger investments possible in companies.
You know, it's atypical to see such a high-profile scientist make this change that you're making right now.
Yeah.
But the way that you laid it out, it almost seems like the next logical move for
For
yourself.
me, it
And
was.
I congratulate you on doing so. So now you can be the man at the helm, making sure that the science that's out there is translated into real clinical practice and tangible results for patients in the near future. And I wish you the best of luck with it. And with that, Philip, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It was truly a pleasure hearing your thoughts today.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Alexander. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Life Sciences Revolution Podcast. I hope you enjoyed, and if you did, please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify. Also, feel free to leave us a comment, question, or suggestion for future episodes. And now, here's In Motion by Cenk Sedup to close us out.